I'm still Mel B., Mel Berger. I'm still an alcoholic. And I'm really almost out of gas, but they didn't want me to tell some of my personal story. Today I talked mostly about the PowerPoint there, which I hadn't seen, but I knew most of the things that were up there. Well, I'm 85 years old. I've been sober since April 15th of 1950, and I've been... thank you. I went to my first AA meeting, though, in early October of 1948 out in Ventura, California area. But I was born in Nebraska at a very early age and grew up there during what is called the Great American Depression. And I used to blame most of my troubles on my parents and my family situation when I grew up. My parents divorced in the mid-30s, and I seemed to have been the kind of the bad guy in the family. If anything went wrong, why, I was the one responsible for it, even if I wasn't there. At least that's what I thought. I didn't get along well in school. I know now that I had a lot of resentments and self-pity and that kind of thing. I had an older sister who did very well in everything, and I was always compared unfavorably with my older sister and a younger brother who came along and did everything well, too. He just passed away a couple of weeks ago. He was 6 years younger than I. And then my parents divorced and my dad remarried, and I never really had a very good relationship with my stepmother. There was always something bad or nothing bad, but it was just maybe my resentment over what had happened. Well, I discovered alcohol. My dad always let me have a sip of beer or whiskey or something like that. In fact, his theory was that if you let people drink moderately, they'll never become drunks. Well, I shot that theory to heck. And the first time I remember really getting drunk, I was home in my dad's house, and he and my stepmother were gone, and I was working on a bicycle. I was maybe 13 or 14 years old, and I started drinking some of his white wine, and I got smashed. And I knew right then what alcohol would do for you. And so ever after that, whenever alcohol was around, I usually overdid it. I went fishing with an uncle, drank all his beer and that kind of thing. I dropped out of school just before World War II started in 1941, and I'd been failing in many of my classes. I actually had only about a year's high school credit. I didn't get a real high school diploma, until I was 41 years old. And I finally got a college degree when I was 50. But I found out that a 50-year-old college graduate is like a 35-year-old virgin. Nobody cares anymore. I drifted down. One incident that stood out, New Year's Eve, 1941, World War II had just started, and I was working in an all-night truck stop out in western Nebraska. Terrible truck stop. No self-respecting trucker would stop there, and I was the all-night guy, the only guy there, and a trucker from Arkansas came in with his girlfriend, had a bottle, and I started drinking with him. And about midnight, that truck driver had knocked me into a snowdrift. I was always hitting people on the fist with my nose once I started drinking. I was actually kind of a fearful, shy, timid guy, but drinking made me change. A few drinks and I could become a different person. And I really think today that that's one of the signs of alcoholism, when a person has this sudden change with just a few drinks. I went down to Denver and worked in an army hospital there, and they let me drink in the PX. And even after I went in town, I'd go back out there and sneak in the PX and pretend to be an employee and drink. And then about May or June of 42, I went out to California and caught a ride with a guy from Salt Lake City to Reno. And he gave me a couple snorts from his bottle. And when I wanted a third snort, he said, "Kid," he said, "you're one of those people who can't drink." I don't know what there was about me after just two drinks that would make him say that, but I guess there I was, 16 years old, and being diagnosed as an alcoholic by another drunk. I guess that was it. And I spent a year out there in the Vallejo, California area, and that's where I learned about wine, that there was such a thing as a wino. And I drank quite a bit of wine off and on that year. I didn't get along very well. I lost jobs and had fights with people and that kind of thing. But that's where I learned the term wino, and I've, even though I drank wine, I was fearful of becoming a wino. But of course, after I got an AA, I learned that there's no real such thing as a wino. That's just a guy that drinks wine because it's cheap. Give him some Chivas Regal, he'll drink that too, you know. I got back to Nebraska, and a short time later, I joined the Navy, and I spent the latter part of the war in the Navy, went out in the Pacific, and I was in five battle stars, but I didn't do much fighting. I was on an amphibious-type ship. And there was one incident, though, that stood out. On March of 1945, late March of 45, we were anchored off the island of Samar in the Philippines, and we were permitted to go ashore on a beer party. They gave us three cans of beer. They carried it on the ship and gave it to you if you were not on the ship. There was a recreation area over on the beach. Well, a Filipino came up, and he had his shirt stuffed with beer bottles, which was called, he said it was potato whiskey. It was $5 or 10 pesos a bottle. Well, I had no intention of buying any of his potato whiskey. And by gosh, I got my three cans of beer, and another guy gave me his, and another guy sold me his, and suddenly there was no more beer on the beach. What did I do? I looked up the potato whiskey man, and I bought one bottle of his stuff, and I remember buying one more bottle, and the next thing I knew, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, 0400 Navy time, and I was on the boat that had been hoisted on the davits, and boy, was I sick. I was terribly sick. I must have thrown up and all of that. Somebody had come along and urinated on me, or at least that frequently happened. After I got sober, those people seemed to disappear who were always doing that. Well, you know, I didn't get anything out of that incident until after I came in AA, and I could look back on it and say, my gosh, perfectly dry without having a drink, I wouldn't touch anything that might be poisonous or something like that. And my God, those nine cans of beer just changed everything. And I think that's what happens to some alcoholics. They start out drinking something and wind up drinking wood alcohol or something and die or that kind of thing. The point is that once we start drinking, why, we throw caution to the winds and do things we wouldn't do perfectly sober. We call up the boss and tell him what a jerk he is and things like that. Well, I got out of the Navy and went back home in Nebraska, and I stayed drunk until my money was gone. And finally, about 1947, I was getting shut off in bars and things like that. And then I drifted out to Idaho, where my father lived, and stayed there for a while. Finally, early in 48, I was wound up destitute in a little town on the Snake River, Weezer, Idaho. And I was too ashamed to go back to my dad's house, so I went out to work on a railroad Gandhi gang on the Union Pacific. These were guys that lived in railroad cars and worked on the track. And I stayed there for about a month. And it kind of scared me because these guys, most of them were alcoholics and had lived years and years up and down that railroad working on the tracks. And most of them didn't have more than the clothes on their backs. It was just, they'd talk about how bad the cops were in Pocatello or Salt Lake City or something like that. So I didn't want to be like those guys. But then I got paid, and I went into Weezer, and I went into a pool hall with a guy, and somebody handed me a beer. Next morning, I wake up in jail, and I didn't even know where they'd found me. They'd found me passed out on this sidewalk. Well, I went back and stayed with my dad for a while, and then I went over to Boise and got drunk again, and I was broke. And I took a cab back without a cent to pay the cab driver. Well, that's not the thing to do. And I wound up getting a 10-day jail sentence over that. Short time after that, I again had a fight with my dad and went down to California where my sister and brother-in-law lived, Ventura, California. And I got started again. I got a job working in the oil fields and everything. But then I started drinking again, and I was right getting in trouble again. One night, the cops took me home, and I missed work and everything else. And finally, that fall, I got in touch with AA. Now, I've covered a lot of time here. There was a lot of bad things happened, blackouts and fights and getting rolled a few times, jailed several times. But that brought me to the point of wanting to go to AA. And there had been a lot of publicity about AA because it was new then. It was only 13 years old. AA had 68,000 members then, I think. I've since built it up to 2 million. And but, you know, a guy called me up a couple days later where I was rooming, and he took me to a meeting over in a little town, Santa Paula, California. And by gosh, that was some meeting. There was about 10 guys down in the church basement. I didn't even like going into church. I was so much against that sort of thing. But a guy came in roaring drunk. And you know, all of the years I've been in AA and meetings I've been to, I've hardly ever seen a guy come to a meeting roaring drunk. And this was a guy that apparently had been in the group there. And those guys were very kind to him. They took him home. Some of them took him home and everything. I thought that was just nice. And I learned a lot about AA, and as I said earlier, the second and third members I met were from Akron. These were the people who told me Bill Dodson was the guinea pig and all that. And they talked about Akron, too, you know. They moved out there from Akron, and they talked about some of those people as casually as you and I would talk about members of our own group, people we knew. So I was really impressed with AA, and I stayed sober for 5 months and really did a pretty good job for a while. But then I got out of work, and for some strange reason, I joined the Army and had no business doing that. And I wound up getting kicked out of the Army in 7 months with an undesirable discharge. I'd gone back to drinking. And the place where I was kicked out was New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's where Camp Kilmer is. That's where I was discharged. And you know, I didn't even get out of Camp Kilmer without getting rolled. I lost my money, my belt, my tie, my railroad ticket, and even my undesirable discharge. Somebody in New Brunswick has an undesirable discharge he didn't earn. Well, I got back to Nebraska, and I stayed that year. That was September of 1949, and I stayed with my mother and stepdad there, and I'm real still ashamed today that I leached on those people, and it was probably a problem to them and all of that. But finally, in early April, I guess, I got a check from the government, and I went on what I hope was my last drunk. And anyway, I wound up real sick and hungover one morning, and the neighbor lady came over and talked me into going out to the state hospital, which was on a hill overlooking the town. So I went out there and signed myself in, and I spent 7 weeks there, and I got back in AA, and I've stayed in AA ever since. This has been my life. That was April 15th, 1950, that I went to that state hospital. The nice thing about a state hospital like that, unlike the treatment centers we have today, is that once you spend a few weeks there, well, you don't want to go back. It wasn't a very pleasant place. Some ways it was good. There was a psychologist on the staff who was quite a bit of help to me. But when I left there, boy, I didn't ever want to go back. It was like being in a minimum security prison, I guess. Well, after a few months in Nebraska, I came out to Pontiac, Michigan. I'd been sober 5 months, I think, when I came. I got an old car that had bald tires and everything. I wouldn't drive such a car across town today, but I drove that 800 miles from Nebraska out to Pontiac, and I had an aunt and uncle there, and they owned a little machine shop in Pontiac, and I went to work for them, and I lived with them for 6 months, and a guy in Nebraska had told me, well, you go out to Pontiac, nobody will even notice you. You'll be just a drop in the bucket out there. Well, that wasn't true. I got to Pontiac, made some of the best friends I ever had. One of them was a Dr. Cobb. I don't know if anybody ever heard of him. Leon Cobb. He died many, many years ago. He died about 50 years ago, I think. But he was a great friend to me. In fact, he even sold me a new car. For some reason, he had a car that he wanted to sell, and he took a mortgage, and that was the first new car I ever got. And then one fellow I met, who really was kind of a legend around here, died a few years ago, was Chauncey Costello. Now, Chauncey had 9 years sobriety when I came out, came to Pontiac, and he met at a group called the Stevens Group at the All Saints Episcopal Church. And, well, anybody with 9 years sobriety in 1950, well, that was an eternity. And, oh, I was just awed by this guy. Well, then I moved away, moved to Detroit, and then to Jackson, Michigan in 1952, where I lived until 1972. But I always heard about Chauncey. I don't think I saw him those many years, but I always heard that he was active and involved, you know. And by gosh, about the early 60s, or I mean the early 200s, I should say, I got an assignment to do some work for Guest House. I helped do their 50th anniversary booklet. And I started going to meetings over here. And darned if Chauncey wasn't going to those meetings. And I got acquainted with him. And he had 65 years sobriety the last time I saw him. And the last place I saw him was the same place where I had first met him, in the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pontiac. My gosh. And then a year or two later, he died, I guess. Well, I also saw him in Toronto in 2005 at the International Convention there. He was in a wheelchair by that time, but this guy was active right up to the very end. Now, I've known other people who have stayed sober 20, 30, 40, 50 years before passing on, which tells me that AA has great staying power. Now, when this Detroit thing was read there, the history, Mike Eshelman, I'm violating these people's anonymity, but they're all gone now and they can't do anything about it. I think I heard Mike Eshelman give a talk in December of 1950. And it was over at Pontiac, a big Saturday night meeting they had. And he had a tremendous story. He had been a superintendent of a parts manufacturing company in Detroit. But he had a drinking problem. And he had been fired under very humiliating circumstances. They made him clean out his desk right in front of everybody and that kind of thing. He went home and he started a little alley shop, but he had this terrible resentment toward the guy who had fired him. Well, then he got sober through Archie Trowbridge and so on. One thing he always talked about was the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. We didn't have much, 1938, we didn't have literature to speak of. But that book really helped him. He first read it. He was in bed, and he had to put it on a pillow to keep it propped up. But anyway, he got sober and even saw the guy who had fired him and went over and shook hands with him and so on. You know, he talked about things like that. But then his little shop suddenly grew into quite a business. I think he had 300 or 400 employees when I heard him speak in Detroit. So he had become a very wealthy man, but a very humble man, never cocky or proud of his success or anything like that. I always remember that he was a good friend of a legendary Salvation officer named Captain Tom Crocker, who had been converted to the Salvation Army after being a drunk on Skid Row in Detroit. And I even heard Tom Crocker speak later on through Mike. This was the sort of guy that really impressed me, partly, I suppose, because of his great business success. But anyway, when he spoke there in 1950, he was 58 years old. And now I was only 25. And when you're 25, anybody 58 is senile, you know. And you know, I thought, well, this guy will be around a few more years and then they'll pack him away. But I went to his 40th AA anniversary down in Grosse Pointe. I was then living in Toledo in 1978, and one of the members knew Mike, too, and he wanted to go to that meeting, and he drove me down there with him. And by gosh, Mike was sober 40 years, and I talked to him a number of times, too. I think he passed away shortly after that. But that's an example of the staying power of AA. We got something pretty good here for the long pull. Now, every now and then you read about some new answer for alcoholism, and oh, it's better than AA and all of that, so on. And then you don't hear anything about it. It doesn't have staying power. See, AA isn't about quitting, it's about staying quit. And if we really follow this program, we can stay quit. And that's what we do. Sometimes people say that we don't, only about 5% of the people who come here get sober or something like that. I don't have any idea what the percentage is, but it never was real high. Even at the first meetings I went to, the people would say, well, if we had, everybody who came here was sober, we'd have to stack them up like cordwood, you know, because so many people had come. There were a lot of people who came and never stayed. But the fact is, we're supposed to have about 2 million people today. And that means that every morning, 2 million people get up and stay sober that day and drive sober and work sober and do all of that and aren't causing a lot of trouble. And so that's something for AA, too. I don't know much about our percentages of those who come in, because I know people come here for lots of reasons. They're sent by the courts, and the boss forces them, or the wife, or somebody, and they have no real interest or desire. But if you come here and you really are done with, know that you've got to change your life, by gosh, it'll work for you. I sometimes tell people that I have 60 years of sobriety, alcohol sobriety, and 49 years of cigarette sobriety, and 10 minutes of emotional sobriety, which that's just my way of saying that we're always working on those personal problems. We don't get perfect or anything like that. And, you know, the old things, this resentments, the laziness, and procrastination, all of the things, the problems we had in sobriety. Gosh, they're in drinking too, you know. I mean, that we had problems in drinking, and they're in sobriety too. They come up in new forms. And so, actually, I've just spent the last 60 years trying to grow up. Now I'm 85, and, well, what do I have left, 25, 30 years? I don't know. It's been a great ride, and a lot of wonderful things have happened to me. I've learned things. Now, my wife is with me tonight. We are staying over in Rochester, that beautiful hotel over there. I'm really impressed. Well, my wife went to high school in Rochester. Her parents lived there, and she graduated from high school there in 1952. And Rochester was a much different place then. And she amazed at what has happened there. But we were married there in the St. John's Lutheran Church, which is only about a mile maybe from where we're staying tonight. It's kind of funny that we went full circle. We celebrated 50 years of marriage on September 3rd. Thank you. At least I celebrated it. I don't know if she did. But the way we met, after I moved to Jackson in 1952, I became involved in a lot of things that I'd never been able to get involved in, drinking. I became an actor in the community theater there. I did 30 plays. And I had, in 1959, I had a role in The Great Sebastians. In fact, I was Sebastian. And there was one scene where Sebastian goes across the stage in his underwear. And she was working on the sets or something for that show. That's the first time she saw me. And she said, I've got to have that man. her parents lived here in Rochester, and when they found out I was in AA, they didn't like that very well. They didn't think it was very good. But in time, why, they began to see that I wasn't a bad guy after all, and it worked out pretty well. We have 4 adult children and 9 grandchildren. And so that's been my story, but I think AA has been the basis for all of it, the principles of AA. Now, I don't think we followed the quiet time that they had in the Oxford group. I got to know quite a bit about the Oxford group. In 1978, the editor of the Grapevine called me and asked me if I knew anything about the Oxford group. Well, I'd read something about it over the years, but they had received a manuscript from a man named Willard Hunter, who was not an alcoholic, But he had been an Oxford grouper since 1938. And they didn't. They had submitted the manuscript for the Grapevine, but they wanted it rewritten. So I wound up meeting Willard Hunter and rewriting the manuscript, and it wound up getting rejected by the Grapevine because they didn't want to give Frank Buchman this much publicity or anything. There are reasons why AA kind of separated itself from the Oxford group, and Bill Wilson was very strong on that point because he felt that it was detrimental to AA to be connected with him after 1936 when Frank Buchman had that unfortunate newspaper interview. And but the four absolutes, Bill always said that those were included in the 12 steps. I'm not sure whether they are or not, but I believe that we try to do pretty much what the Oxford group was doing. And the point is, it has worked for us very well over the years. Willard, he was a guy who had left Harvard Law School just to become part of the Oxford group and follow Frank Buchman. And he had quite a career. He is a great guy. We became good friends. He died a couple years ago. But it seemed to me partly that he was trying to remarry AA and the Oxford group. I think we learned a lot from the Oxford group, and we ought to honor them for all the good that they did for us and for the wonderful principles we got. But we shouldn't be affiliated with them in any way. That's part of our history. But for that matter, we shouldn't be affiliated with anybody. We should cooperate with, this is part of our tradition. We cooperate with everybody who comes along. And well, my gosh. Well, thank you for that applause. I'll go back and tell the people in Toledo that I got a standing ovation. I mean, ovulation, is that, what is it? But I've had a great time in AA. I think that the program has guided me. Now, my wife and I, we do our prayers every morning using the Daily Word meditation book and my own meditation book, and it seems to suffice for us. It carried us along. We've used the Daily Word probably for 40 years. But there are plenty of good meditation books. The early members of AA, I think they used one called The Upper Room. Probably you'll find one right here in this church that would be very good. Anything that gets us centered on God, our higher power, right action, right thoughts, I think it works for us. And there have been many, many times when I've done the wrong thing, and then I've been able to draw back my horns and think about it, go back and make amends or make some change. I've kept from making big mistakes. When I moved to Detroit from Pontiac, I worked in an engine plant on the west side of Detroit. And I was working on assembly. And we worked on these little engines, and then we were supposed to push them along to the next station when we got done with what we were doing. And a guy working with me, he kept trying to boss me. He wasn't the foreman or anything, but he kept telling me not to put my hand behind the engine when I pushed it. Well, one day, I mistakenly had my hand there, and I just happened to turn around, and he had a look of hatred on his face, and he pushed the next engine right up there, and just in time, I pulled my hand out. Oh, gosh, I would have broken every hand in my body with those two engines coming together that way. And just for a second, or maybe a half second, there was a big crescent wrench laying there on the tool belt, and I felt like picking up that crescent wrench and working this nut over. But then, just as fast, something hit me, and I had no resentment or anything at all. I just went on, kept about my work. You know, today, I can't tell you what that guy looked like. I don't even remember how old he was or anything. But, of course, if I'd picked up that wrench, I would be joined to him at the hip. There was no question about that. So I think the program, even when we're not on the thinking rightly ourselves for a moment, the program helps us. Something in the big book says there are times when we're without defense against the first drink. Well, there are times when we're out without defense against that first terrible thought or the emotion and so on. But if we keep reading our literature and doing our meditations and trying to help others as best we can, by gosh, something will come through for us when we need it, the time we best need it. Well, I want to sit down now. I think I've run completely out of gas. But I, you know, I close my talks in a funny way, and I'm not sure that this will be acceptable to this audience. But I have a song that I wrote, and I copied somebody's tune, of course. And, of course, I thought I was plagiarizing, but somebody said, well, when the composer hears you sing it, he won't recognize his tune. It's a tribute to Bill and Bob. And, you know, when I was in the sixth grade, I tried to sing in front of the class, and I failed. And I was 38 years old before I could sing a song before an audience. It took me that long, but it took AA that I was finally able to come around to that. And the name of this song is Once There Were Founders, and it's a tribute to Bill and Bob. Oh, I did sing a song for an older couple out in Palm Springs one day at an aviation convention, and a guy came up afterwards and he said, God, I always wished I could sing. Now I wish you could. So you don't have to make any judgment. I'll just go ahead and sing the song and then I'll sit down. Once there were founders, two men we esteem. They had a vision, a sort of a dream. And though they had struggles, they'd never complain. I wish they were with us again. Once there was darkness, no answer was known. Each of us faced a grim future alone. Then came their vision, and new life appeared. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, we honor them still, a doctor named Bob and a broker named Bill. Dim was the path when their journey began. I wish they were with us again. So over the long years, their stories were told, and lost souls began to return to the fold. All that they told us turned out to be true. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, both gentle and kind. They gave us this program. It's yours and it's mine. When we came broken, they helped us to mend. I wish they were with us again. So remember the gift from the founders we love, with help from our friends and the power above. Each day we have is a journey begun. I feel they're now with us again. Yes, I feel they're now with us again. Thank you.